speakers and talks that we have heard today and during this week. I was thinking that it is very important to remind that this project, which has been so graciously accepted by Mr. and Mrs. Nakhchivani, comes from the inspiration of the Continental Board of Councillors of Europe, who some years ago were thinking to create a generation of learned youth that in future could help Baha'i communities and in their deeper understanding of the faith, and to create new generations of learners, of learned people who could also teach the cause and defend it. It was during the conference in Palermo for the 50th anniversary of the establishment of the faith in that island that it was possible to meet Mr. and Mrs. Nakhchivani and to share with them this idea. And little by little, the project was molded, and we are now at the second year of this course. And unfortunately, today we are at the eve of the closure of this second year. Some of you came here for the first time, and others are here for the second year. We have a bounty, anyway, that everything that has been studied and said and reminded here, it has been possible to publish it. And also for this gathering, of the gathering of this year, again, already arrangements have been made to have also this material available. It is a sad moment because departure is approaching. But I have the privilege and the honor to invite you and also to encourage your national spiritual assemblies to help you to come back again for the third year. Exactly in 1 year, there will be the third seminar, which again will be held by Mr. and Mrs. Nakhchivani and Bahir Nakhchivani. I have the title, and Mr. Nakhchivani shared the title today with us. The title is Shoghi Effendi, the range and power of his pen. So the focus will be on the writings of the beloved guardian. And really it is the final part of an opportunity that we hope it will be followed by a fourth and a fifth meeting. And who knows? So start making now your arrangements and your programs, because what we are witnessing here in this room is the history of the faith, and we have the opportunity to be a part of it. I don't want to take your time, but I am sure that I'm not myself greeting and thanking Mr. and Mrs. Nakhchivani, but I am doing this on behalf of everybody here in this room. Like our chairman said, it is impossible to find appropriate words. And really it comes from the deep of the heart of the National Spiritual Assembly, the appreciation for your presence here and for all your efforts that are a guidance for all of us. So thank you very much. And these goes beyond our words. because they go into the feelings. We thank very much Bahie, who is also a very mostly important part in this project, not only for her assistance here in the courses, but all for all the work that she is carrying out dietro le quinte, below the curtains. We cannot see it, but it is very, very much important. The talks have a double combination, because they combine knowledge, love for the faith, together with experience and service. And this is very much important, because I think that each one of you will have to go back to his community, to their community, to share this, and so to fulfill immediately an act of service. We would like to thank Mrs. Margaret Appa, who is here for the first time, and I think that she has been instrumental also in several parts, and Mrs. Martine Dahl, who registered this conference, providing not only a text but also an audiovisual instrument for us to remember. And I would like to thank the two commissions, the one for the secretariat, who has been very helpful in collecting and preparing the program, and to support Mr. and Mrs. Nakhjavani in the preparation of the material, and the logistic commission, which has been very helpful in organizing all the details and the logistic part of this conference. Again, thank you very much. And I really have no words, and the National Spiritual Assembly of Italy is really hoping that also after this cycle of studies, you will be back again in Italy with us. Thank you very much.
There's supposed to be a program here about the children of the crusade, and we're the only two children. They wanted to ask us to tell you some memories that we had about being children during this wonderful period. And I suddenly feel very much like a child. yes. What was it like to be a child of the crusade? We thought that it would be a nice idea to give you a little glimpse from our worm's eye point of view. And I thought I would start my little memories of being a child of the crusade where my mother left off, well, almost where she left off, in her wonderful, wonderful talk this afternoon. You remember when she finally brought it to a closure? You see, my orange juice had been trembling. You remember where I left you with my propellers? Well, when they were going on this very dramatic trip, I kind of got sent somewhere else. I was sent to Kenya, and I was waiting for them to come back. But you sort of don't quite remember these things when you're little, you know. In fact, I sort of forgot about them, to be honest with you. I went off, and after the initial disastrous feeling of being abandoned and lost, and who was this horrible Englishwoman on the plane, when I arrived at the other end, I had this fantastic family waiting for me, the wonderful family of the Yazdis, who were in Kenya at the time. It was called Kenya in those days, in the city of Nairobi, which to my eyes looked like a very sophisticated place. It seemed to be very much sort of very elegant. Well, I didn't really know the word elegant, but it seemed to be very sort of big compared to what I was used to. And then we went to this house, and there were the girls, you know, there were three girls, and I had been all alone, you know, with all these grown-ups. So suddenly there were all these kids, so it was great fun, and we had tremendous sort of games and things, and I got quite scared because they used to sort of tease me sometimes at night, and I wasn't used to being teased. I took myself very seriously. So there were some tests, shall we put it that way? There were some tests. But nevertheless, there was a savior in my life. And all these people I'm mentioning, you will recall from my mother's wonderful stories, the greatest savior of my life was Auntie Claire. Auntie Claire came to my rescue. And she had this wonderful German accent. So she used to speak with this sort of German thing. And she would say, she used to say, I came mit her with was a kind of mit, but with. It was kind of mit. It was sort of, I came with the sewing machine, she said. I came with the sewing machine. So she was actually saying that she brought her sewing machine, but I got the impression that she had traveled on the sewing machine. You know how people come by train and plane? Well, Auntie Claire came on the sewing machine. So I saw her coming on the sewing machine, you know, riding like a, you know. She came to my rescue on the sewing machine. Well, she wasn't the only one in the Yazdi household, which was filled with wonderful pioneers during those days. And I was quite dazzled because there were several blondes, and, you know, I wasn't used to blondes. There was one blonde lady called Irene Bennett, who was tremendously thin and wore very red lipstick. And she was just the greatest thing since sliced bread, as far as I could see, because she was so young and blonde, and she looked like something out of the movies. And then there was this other very dashing young man. I may be getting confused with his appearance later on, but I don't think so. He was right there in 1953, Ted Cardell. And we, the girls, the Yazdi girls and my humble self, we were absolutely convinced that Irene Bennett was going to marry Ted Cardell. So, I mean, we didn't really know what the plans of the 10-year crusade were, but we were sure. We were sure that that was one of them. Anyway, as you can see, I was quite preoccupied with all kinds of very important issues while my parents were involved in taking Mr. Olinga to the other side of the world. And as I mentioned, there were moments when I sort of forgot kind of them. And it was all very exciting. And then one day, as we were playing with cardboard boxes, because, you know, when you cut a door in a cardboard box and then windows, you can sort of walk with your fingers like that, and you can make, you know, there was a whole world inside this cardboard box. So I can remember sort of doing this inside my cardboard box, and then suddenly there was the sound of a car coming into the driveway, and the Yazdi girls jumped up, and they were very, you know, they were all of them very thin and leggy and kind of ran like that. And so they were all, and I, as you may recall from my photograph, was rather round. So... So they rushed off, and I could hear them shouting, they're coming, somebody had come, Uncle Ali and Auntie Violette, they said. So I thought, oh, what fun, some more people have come. So I ran after them. Uncle Ali and Auntie Violette, you know. And I looked at these two people stepping out of the car, and they were very brown and very thin and very familiar. And I suddenly realized who they were. And as far as I was concerned, that was when the 10-year crusade began. That was the most wonderful moment of my life. And we sat in the car, and they drove me back home, and I sang We Three Kings of Orientar all the way. And that was the beginning of this magnificent crusade for me. And there were many people that came to the house, and many wonderful things that occurred. And there was one memory that my mother recalled earlier on this week, which I have to tell you about, because the most important thing was this connection that we felt from this house where I was growing up in Kampala, and the address was number 3, Kitante Road. We also had a post box. The post box was very important because, you see, my grandmother had to go there at least twice a day to find out whether there was any post from her sons. So we would go visit this post box like you would normally go and visit a shrine or something to see if there was any mail. But when there wasn't any mail, you know, it was a bad day. But at any rate, even if there wasn't mail, there would be this wonderful sound coming up the driveway. Ring, 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 ring. And it was the little guy on that bicycle. You remember she mentioned the little fellow on the bike? He would come up to the front of the house. And he would get off his bicycle, and there would be these little brown envelopes. Now, when you opened the brown envelope, inside there was a piece of paper, also slightly sort of beige, if I remember. And on it, there would be pieces of tape stuck, you know, white tape. With words. Chum, 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 chum. This were the words of Shoghi Effendi. At the end it always said, Shoghi. I was absolutely sure he licked every piece of tape. He must have been sitting there in Haifa going, you know. I couldn't understand quite why he wrote such funny English, though, because he left out half the words, you know. But I figured that, you know, he must have been in a tremendous hurry to get that, because these things were coming on a regular basis. There were so many of them, he must have been really busy, you know. He must have had no spit left. He was so close. I had the impression that that little man on the bicycle had just come from Haifa. Box 155, over there, from Shoghi Effendi. He was coming all the way on his bicycle, up and down those hills, all the way across Africa, until he came to our house, 3 Kitante Road. We had a box, as I said. Ours was box 480, Kampala, Uganda. I used to practice it on the envelope. Box 480, Kampala, Uganda, British East Africa, Africa, the world. Sometimes I pushed it a bit further and I'd write, the galaxy. And then, of course, if there was room on the envelope, the universe. And I used to write letters because, I mean, this is what they all did, you know. Sitting in this house, I mean, there were cables coming, there were letters going. I mean, I just had to get into the, you know, you had to get into the swing of it. So I used to see my father typing away and, you know, my grandfather would have to sign his name. So what they discovered was it would be very good to get a little stamp with my grandfather's signature because he was Hand of the Cause Musa Banoni, you know. But he had his own little signature. And so I used to get to, in the space, you see, you'd get the letter written, ding, 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 and then you'd get to the last words, yours in his name, with a capital H, yours in his name, and then there would be a space. And underneath it would say, Musa Banoni. That was the name of my grandfather. And I'd get to go, boom, with a stamp, you know, in between those two. It was just the greatest thing. Boom. I'd keep doing it on all the letters that they had to send out. So I was really into letter writing. So when it came to the day when my brother was born, which was the greatest achievement, the best goal of the 10-year crusade, was in 1954. To heck with all the knights of Baha'u'llah, I got a brother. So when I had a brother, I had to write to some of the most important people in my life. Auntie Claire was at that time, I think, pretty close, so I didn't write to her. But I did write to another auntie of mine called Auntie Ursula Samandari, who was the most wonderful human being and who taught me the color purple. You know, when you mix red and blue, it becomes this purple. And so I wrote to her that I had a baby brother, you know. It was important. I told her I had this brother, and I got to the end of the letter, and I wrote, "Yours in his name, Musa Banani." Well, the goals and the years went on, and wonderful things were happening, unbeknownst to me, because I was a very spoilt little girl. And finally, we came to the year 1957, and we lost Shoghi Effendi. And of course, when that cable came, everything changed in the house. And there was a continental conference that was being prepared for. And I remember very, very well that when the friends came from Iran, how they were dressed in black, from top to toe in black. And how Ruhi Khanum shone like a queen in white. She was really extraordinary. She was just unbelievable. When she walked into the hall, when the Baha'is were waiting for her to first arrive, when she walked into the hall and the entire hall stood up and they all began to chant this magnificent prayer that the African believers had themselves created, really, the Aloha Pa. I'm sure you all know it. Maybe you would like to sing it. Because that was how we welcomed Ruhi Khanum to that conference. And everyone stood up, and it seemed to me that in their voices, there was something being raised up in the air that was like an arch that went right over her head. And she walked up the aisle and up to the steps, and rose to the podium like this shining white light as everybody was singing, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Well, it was the midpoint of the 10-year crusade, and my childhood was practically over. So from that point on, I really didn't have much of a child's perspective on the crusade, because soon after that, I had to leave Africa and come to school in England. But I had one last little childhood experience related to the crusade that I have to tell you about. And that was that one of the days during the conference, all the Persian friends wanted to go to a park. Now, they were hot, they were tired, they were sort of looking for a little bit of a breeze. It was the dry season. And they said to me, "Do you know of a place where we could go to a park?" And I said, "Sure I do. I know a park. I can take you to this park." In fact, I remembered, you know, it wasn't very far. You just go through that road, and then you go down that hill, and then you go up there, then you go across there, and you go down that long road, going towards Jinja, and then just before you get to the big main road, there it is. I remembered it very well. I said, "I can take you there." So, this large group of Persian Baha'is, dressed in black from head to foot, with high heel shoes, pointed toes, frothy petticoats, lots of makeup. And they started following me. And we walked, and we walked. And you know, in the beginning, they were very polite, you know. Bahi Khanu. I took them, and I took them, and I took them, By the time they came to that park, they were just exhausted. They were struggling. They were gasping. They were sweating. They had taken their shoes off. They were limping. We got to the gates of the park, and the gates were shut. Margaret has other stories to tell that go on from 1958 onwards. So I leave her from that point of chronology. Sorry? Sure. Yeah.
No, you tell that story. You tell it to me.
Well, all right. So the moment came when they had to send me to boarding school. And this didn't seem to me to be a very useful goal of the 10-year crusade. In fact, I really rather flinched and hesitated on this subject. I'm not sure it exactly relaxed me either, but there we were in England, which was not at all like Uganda. So I was being introduced to some of the worthy English Baha'is. So I remember being taken from house to house and meal to meal and school to school. And then one day I was taken to the north of London and we were introduced to Mr. and Mrs. Wade, who were pillars of the British community. And they had the nicest, kindest, sweetest little girl who was just so nice to me and so kind. And here she is.
There's no way I'm going to be able to follow that. Absolutely no way. But that was the first time that Bahia and I met, and we played in the back garden, if I remember, for a while the worthy Baha'is chatted inside and drank English tea, probably, more than likely. So that was when we first met. And perhaps I better start my memories, really. My sort of earliest memories of when I was about 10, so I don't go quite as far back as Bahia does in remembering, but I can remember my father, who was, as Bahia said, had not been a Baha'i for very long, because he'd probably been a Baha'i for about 2 years, but he was already on the National Teaching Committee, so you can know he was that sort of person. And I can remember he installed the National Teaching Committee office at home, so we had a full-time secretary in the house. And I was 10, but I can remember the lady, and she's actually pioneering in the Northern Isles of the British Isles. And I can remember all the activity that there was, all the letters being written, and all the work that was being done in the office full-time at home. So that was perhaps my earliest memory of the work that my father was involved in. And then in 1957, of course, was the time when Choge Effendi passed away, and we were, in fact, the closest family to the cemetery where he was buried. And so I didn't go to the funeral, and I cannot remember why that was. It was possibly that children weren't encouraged to come. I was 11 years old, but I didn't go to the funeral. But I do remember afterwards the early stages, when it was simply just a big mound of flowers, and there were lots and lots of visitors and lots of people coming by, obviously. People who were very emotional and upset, because there were many people who came for the funeral. But I can also remember that we had lots of visitors at home, because my parents being close by, we would have lots of visitors coming through. So I can remember lots of people coming through home and being with us. But then perhaps my biggest memory was, I was a little bit older, was 1963 with the World Congress, and we were all there. Although I don't actually remember meeting Bahia there, but then there were 7,000 people, so, it was easy to miss out. But my father was, as Ms. Nakhchivani actually mentioned, was on the organising committee. Family of organisers, unfortunately. We're all... I pity my poor daughter. She's got a lot of organising coming down to her. He was on the organising committee of the World Congress, so at the time, I had learnt to taught myself a little bit before then, but I taught myself to do Italic handwriting. So my father was quite impressed with this. So he said, would you like to help me? Would you like to, no, I've got something that we've got to do. I said, yes, sure, of course I can. No, whatever, what do you want me to do? And they had little, and I don't know what you would call them, there were little booklets for the World Congress. They were pale blue little booklets which had the tickets for each of the sessions. Do you remember? Each of the tickets, so that when you went into the World Congress, the ticket was taken out and you could go in. It was a security measure. Each of these, now you can remember, there were 6,000 or 7,000, between 6,000 or 7,000, were handwritten, individually named. Now, I don't think I wrote out 7,000. I don't think so, but I do remember writing out a lot of them. And I still have my own that I have kept for memory's sake. But that was one of my memories there. But perhaps the memory of the Congress itself, when that started, to sit in the Albert Hall. How many of you have been or seen the Albert Hall? Has anybody seen it? Some of you have, okay. But to go in there and see the whole of the Albert Hall filled from top to bottom with Baha'is was just mind-blowing, absolutely mind-blowing. I mean, I came from a community which was small. No, we weren't a big community. Well, London actually was one community, but it wasn't too big in terms of the numbers in communities today. I think there were, that time, about 75 Baha'is in the whole of London. So it wasn't huge. No, it wasn't huge. So to sit in there and see 6,000-7,000 Baha'is sitting there was just absolutely mind-blowing. And then I was trying to recall the sort of the moments, the special moments. Obviously, when the members of the Universal House of Justice came, that was obviously a very special moment. You can't replace that as a moment. Seeing everybody there and seeing my father, looking down and seeing my father, who was very keen on... He was part of the organising team, but one of his jobs was to protect Rehe Khanum, because she was otherwise she was mobbed. And I do have a photograph at home of him actually in a line, you know, holding back the crowds and allowing Rehe Khanum to pass by. And this was his sort of constant job. He was the white shirt, flashing around and doing everything that had to be done. But some of the individuals that I remember, which you probably remember too, the Aborigine, Uncle Fred. Remember Uncle Fred? Just a wonderful person who travelled all the way from Australia, a real live Aborigine from Australia, who was called Uncle Fred, and he came up onto the podium and actually spoke to the audience. Mr. Samandari, very special memory. But my memory is sort of, I can't remember individual names. Mind you, I haven't had long to think about it because it was only today that we said, can we do something together? Another one is another of my memories of that time when I honestly do not logistically know how they organise it. My father actually organised, or with the committee organised, for all those people, the 6,000 or 7,000 people at the Congress, to go by coach to visit the Guardian's resting place. Now, the effect on Southgate, which is a little suburb of northern London, was quite amazing because, to see all these people from all over the world come by coachload day after day was a huge effect. And my job, the job I was given, being organiser's daughter, you were given the prize jobs, you know. My job was to sit just inside the entrance to the... to the cemetery. And those of you who've been there, been to Southgate Cemetery, when you walk down the road just before you get to the Guardian's resting place, there's a big gateway that's been installed there. And that gateway was originally outside by the road and was the main entrance in. And there was a little hut. It literally was like a little garden shed. And I can remember sitting in there and filling little brown envelopes with rose petals that had been taken from the flowers that had been on Shoghi Effendi's resting place, putting those little flowers in envelopes in order that every visitor would go back with a little brown envelope of petals. That's perhaps the most of the memories that I can think of right at the moment. Thank you.
Hello, Appa. Okay, now we're going to see a PowerPoint about the 10-year crusade. And we will see how from these pioneers, great communities were built and flourished. We will see some photos from those days and some from nowadays and from the jubilees that were celebrated in those countries which were opened by the pioneers during the 10-year crusade. While you will be watching the movies, you will listen to some stories on personal experiences of some of those people who were living the 10-year crusade. Especially, we will listen to a story about the family Alai in Samoa and the family Aif in Namibia. This is just to give you a glimpse of the spirit that was blowing during the 10-year crusade. Enjoy the video.
Act as though it had all been answered. Then act with tireless, ceaseless energy. And as you act, you yourself will become a magnet, which will attract more power to your being until you become an unobstructed channel for the divine power to flow through you. When on pilgrimage, Haifa in January 1957, the beloved guardian asked them to pioneer to Africa because there are no German pioneers in Africa and a German youth should go there. It was their greatest desire to fulfill this request of the beloved guardian. Once the decision was taken, it was to overcome some difficulties like: which country should they be going to? How could they come up for the living? Should the father go ahead to find work, and my mother with our 6 children follow later? After letters and applications had been sent out, it was finalized that they would go to Southwest Africa, today's Namibia. And only with the help of Emmerich Zala, my father received a work permit allowing them to enter Southwest Africa. Finally, the whole family left from Rotterdam by ship, arriving 19 days later in Walvisbaai on July 2, 1959. Southwest Africa, being a former German colony, was now under the government of South Africa, where the laws of apartheid had been enforced and it was ruling the daily life. The whites had all the benefits. The native Africans were underprivileged and deprived of their most basic human rights, like free speech, self-government, being able to travel freely. The country was the size of Germany, France, and Benelux states together, with a population of 1 million, originating from 11 different ethnic groups. In such a big country, the only Baha'is were two African friends, and the Knight of Baha'u'llah, Ted Lardell, with his young wife Alicia, were residing in Southwest Africa. Later left for East Africa 3 weeks after our arrival. The reaction to my parents' wish to go pioneering to this dark continent was not met with enthusiasm by all. The reactions were more like, "This is totally irresponsible. How are they going to come up for their living?" There was always something going on. Hearing about our parents' plans, it was excitement. Yes, we are going to Africa. Adventure, of course. Well, we were soon going to find out what it really meant. The trip by boat was great fun, but I remember on arriving everything was different. Getting on the train, I made sure that all windows stayed shut. The lions could have jumped in. And going to school 2 days after our arrival, my brother and I, in typical German Lederhosen, leather shorts, and sandals. Oh boy, where did these guys come from? Of course, they were snow bantus from Germany that still had eyes on their heads. It was so obvious. We were different. Well, we made sure to adapt as soon as possible, and within 3 months, we spoke English and Afrikaans. But wherever youth are, they are challenged with peer pressure. More difficult was the fact that no schoolmates knew we were Baha'is. There were no other Baha'is in the whole country to communicate, to share, and to support us in overcoming these challenges. The political system did not allow us to speak openly about the faith or freely meeting our fellow believers. The mail was opened, the telephone calls were taped, and we were observed by the police and even by our neighbors. Why are the Ives friendly with the Africans? Just meeting for a celebration was sometimes quite exciting. Who will attend? Wonderful, some African friends managed to come. Finally, we're sitting together, having devotions, sharing news. Suddenly, there is a knock at the door. Who could it be? Some friends arriving a little late? Or perhaps the neighbors, just wanting to say hi? Or even the police? Interracial meetings would automatically be considered as political gatherings. These could mean arrest or even having to leave the country within few times a week. Only after 18 years it was finally possible to speak freely about our beloved faith and visit the native homelands. Back at those years, I'm deeply grateful to my parents for answering our beloved Shori Effendi's call to pioneer, for showing us their unshakable love and trust in Baha'u'llah, their perseverance and true dedication. I never heard them regret their decision, but rather asking for forgiveness for missed opportunities. Surely we children had to go through some hardship. On the long run, we benefited from it. Here we learn to appreciate in what we have, rather than always asking for more. Although the Africans go through so much more struggle for the daily things in life, they are still able to show joy and genuine love. although I'm living outside of Africa for so many years, I can never forget those most important years of my upbringing in Namibia. My heart is still there.
I can remember our arrival as if it was yesterday. On a starry night, the Matua anchored in the harbor. The sky was full of jewels. This was after a long journey by propeller plane from Tehran through many countries new to us and a month's delay in Fiji. It seemed we had left a lot behind, a big family, a comfortable home, a familiar place. But only time would tell that this step, which my courageous parents took, would be a great gift to us. My first recollection is the night we met dear Fuatino Tamasese on the road outside our house in Papauta. I remember the road being quite dark. My mother wanted to go for a walk, I think just to break the tedium of being at home hours on end, in a place where we were fairly recently arrived and where we knew no one. My sister and I went with her for company. This meeting, of course, led to a Fuatino finding out we were Baha'is, telling her father, Mr. Sayalala Tamasese, about our religion, which in turn led to him asking to come and meet my parents. He was such a ready soul. Due to his own deep study of the Bible, he quickly recognized the manifestation of God for this day. He was a remarkable man, and today his legacy lives on his family. What a joyous day that was, the day of his formal declaration. I remember the adults in my family being so ecstatic. On reflection, I am sure they were also thinking about the joy news of the first Samoan Baha'i would bring to the heart of the beloved guardian. You know, in those days, the only communication we had with the rest of the world was twice a month when a banana boat from New Zealand would bring our mail and take letters we had written. That will give you an idea of how everyday life has changed on this island in 50 years. So a major activity in those times was a trip to the post office twice a month. Every 2 weeks, we would all go and wait around for the mail to be sorted. Keep checking the post box, being so happy when letters arrived from family and friends, and so disappointed when they didn't, because that meant another 14 days before getting news. Any news of births, deaths, marriages, illness, accidents, of whatever family members were in good health and doing well. In my parents' case, they had three more children in other parts of the world, brothers, sisters, and a very extensive family. In Lillian's case, she had her parents and a brother elsewhere, in addition to friends and relatives. People usually say the pioneer is a great sacrifice. They usually say it with the popular meaning of the word, to give something up, forgetting the rest of this definition, that you are giving up something for the sake of something even greater. But if we are doing something out of love for Baha'u'llah and for humanity, and we are happy doing it, then how can it be just a sacrifice? It is also a great joy and a great privilege.
Mrs. Hönke. Her nursing qualifications enabled her to quickly answer a call to take the faith to the Admiralty Islands, now Manus Province, in Papua New Guinea. Her arrival fulfilled a goal of a 10-year plan to spread the Baha'i teachings worldwide. For this service, the then head of the faith, Shori Effendi, bestowed upon her the accolade of Knight of Baha'u'llah. Mrs. Hönke invited local people to her home in the Admiralty Islands and held first aid classes for them, which prompted criticism from members of the European community who practiced racial segregation. She met up with the only other Baha'i in Papua New Guinea, Rodney Hancock, a 21-year-old New Zealander who had arrived in Rabaul about the same time that Mrs. Hönke had first arrived in the Admiralty Islands. In 1956, after being introduced to the Baha'i faith by Mrs. Hönke and Mr. Hancock, a teacher on Manus Islands, Apelles Mazakmat, became the first Papua New Guinean Baha'i. In the subsequent years, as thousands entered the faith, more than 150 Baha'is from other countries came to Papua New Guinea to assist the local Baha'is as they administered and developed their national community. Mr. Hancock said that Mrs. Hönke had corresponded with many Baha'is over the decades. She must have written hundreds, if not thousands, of letters to encourage the friends in their endeavors, he said. Mr. Hancock also spoke of the difficulties of introducing the faith in the 1950s, when the Australian administration disapproved of any friendly association between expatriates and local people. He had to obtain special permission from the government before visiting villages. It took more than a year before he and Mrs. Hönke could introduce the faith to the first Papua New Guinean to become a Baha'i, Apelles Mazakmat, a teacher from Munawai village in New Ireland. He, Mr. Mazakmat, told me when he first heard of the faith from Mrs. Hönke, it was like the answer to all his dreams, and he wished to learn more about the teachings of Baha'u'llah, Mr. Hancock wrote in his book titled Long Pela Bunating, My Life as a Baha'i Pioneer in Papua New Guinea.
Esteemed visitors to the country 13 years before normal Baha'i activity could commence. Those visitors were the then head of the faith, Shoghi Effendi, and his wife, Madame Ria Rabbani, who who in 1940 drove across the eastern region of the Belgian Congo. In 1953, Baha'is began formal efforts to start teaching the Baha'i faith as part of a worldwide 10-year plan directed by Shoghi Effendi to bring the message of Baha'u'llah to the world. Before that time, colonial authorities did not permit the promotion of the faith by Baha'i pioneers, people who moved to that country to establish the Baha'i community. Active attempts in spread the teachings began in 1953 when Alinak Javani and his wife Violette, driving across Africa from Uganda, took Ugandan Baha'i Samson Mungongo to the city of Kamina. The Nakjavanis carried on to the Middle Congo and British Cameroon. Congolese who had become Baha'is in Rwanda, Burundi, moved back to settle in their home provinces. The first local spiritual assembly was elected in 1957, and there are now 541 assemblies. The first National Spiritual Assembly formed in 1970. Traveling long distances within the country is often extremely difficult, so in some regional centers, Baha'is are unable to attend the Jubilee festivals in Kinshasa, held their own celebrations in support of the main event. She would say, "Mulamba, take this faith as if it were your personal belonging, because a personal belonging is something you take care of, something you love," said Mr. Munanga. "As I always felt the truth of this word, I have always taken the faith as a personal belonging, and I have always wanted to serve as much as possible I can. If Baha'u'llah can give me the time and the strength to do so for the rest of my life."